Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host Arsene Kashkashian here in studio with the author who we have been reading for the month of December. So Arsene, what is the chosen book and what have we been reading?
We're reading R.L. Mayes's new book, A Complete Fiction.
Well, R.L. Mayes is joining us in the studio, and this is your second trip to the book club. Last time it was during COVID, so we were wearing masks and sitting 10 feet apart. So it's good to have you with us right here in the studio. It's a little bit cozier. Welcome.
Thank you so much. So nice to be here.
Well, A Complete Fiction, it's a great read. And really at the centre of it are two authors who have quite an antagonistic relationship that plays out on social media. But really at the crux of the story is an issue that Arsene Kashkashian writes about in one of the blurbs for the book, because if you read this book, you'll see Arsene's little quotes on it. And really, essentially, it's about who has the right to tell a story. And so as an author yourself, why was this something you wanted to explore?
I think authors are always wrestling with this story. Nonfiction writers wrestle with it more than fiction writers because they're telling true stories that can never be entirely their own, a memoir writer, for example. But fiction writers wrestle with it as well. We have seeds of our fiction that come from real stories, so that's part of the reason. And it's very much in the zeitgeist right now to think about who has the right to tell a story. You know, if you're not from a particular culture or group, do you get to tell the stories of that particular culture or group? This book doesn't exactly center that question. It's really more of the family issue. You know, does she have a right in this book to tell her sister's story?
And so why don't you take us to the two authors? So tell us a little bit about George and a little bit about PJ, and where are they in their life when this book opens?
So PJ is in her 30s, and she's been struggling to get a book published. This is the third one she's written, and none of them have sold to publishers. So she's quite frustrated. She's wondering if she's spent her life in the right way. She's in her mid-30s. She's divorced. She's struggling. Then George is an editor at a very tiny publisher in New York. And his professional career is fine. But he, too, is a struggling writer. But his book has just been purchased for $1 million.
And that's what sets off the dynamic that carries throughout the whole book. And so the book is told from two points of view. You get one chapter's PJ, then one chapter's George, then it's PJ. Tell us why you decided to tell the story in this way and what it allowed you to do to tell a more complete story.
I often write with more than one narrative voice. In this story, it really allowed me to explore the questions that I was trying to look at in the book from different perspectives. So each of the characters could embody a different perspective, maybe a different answer to the question. But of course, also, you get to then know what more of the characters are thinking, feeling. It's a nice way to tell a story. You can't tell the story of too many of them, meaning from the point of view of too many characters, or the writer gets a little confused, or maybe the writer too gets a little confused. But two, I find, is a very nice way to do it. I really admire Jodi Picoult. She does this. Her books, of course, have even more points of view often, and each chapter will take a different point of view, and you get a really complete story and analysis of what she's trying to look at.
Well, as we mentioned at the start, this really is about the relationship that's very antagonistic between these two authors, but they don't actually communicate directly until the very end. And their communication and the antagonism is playing out on social media. And this is another thing that's in the zeitgeist very much, cancel culture and how that plays out on social media. And you've created a whole new social media platform, Crave, that's the avenue for all of this communication. So tell us a little bit about Crave, because I really wanted this to be a real thing, because I'm like dying to get on Crave. Talk a little bit about this and why you wanted to create a new social media platform.
I mean, one reason I wanted to is just I thought it would be great fun. And another reason was that initially the book had Twitter. And, you know, as we were talking about, at this point, people might bring their own feelings to Twitter. I mean, they might bring their own feelings to any one of the social media sites that are so popular. So creating my own gave me the freedom, allowed me to be free of that. You know, that people would bring less to it and I could maybe have them feel the way I wanted them to feel about it. But really, truly, it was really fun to write. In the book, the site is called Crave. People nibble instead of tweeting or posting. If you like someone's nibble, you munch it. There are menus. You're invited to join the meal by the app. So it was really a lot of fun to write. And I often feel that if I'm having fun while I'm writing something, the reader will have fun as well. I don't want them to be an only heavy experience. Even if I'm dealing with heavy subjects, I want the reader to periodically get a break and to laugh and to just have, you know, a break from their life even, mm-hmm. you know, through the book.
Well, there are a lot of laughs in this book. It's one of the things I liked. And it moves quickly. I can't believe how fast I read the book. I mean,
me too. I mean,
just gobbled, to use the terminology.
Exactly. I gobbled it up as well because there's a lot going on, but I kept wanting to get to the next chapter. And I think this goes back to what you were asking earlier, Arson, writing from the two perspectives and alternating, because often you write from PJ's perspective, but I want to hear what George feels about this. So the next chapter will give me that insight, but then we're back to PJ. So I found that technique is a real propulsion. It was very propulsive then, really got me through the book.
Well, why don't we have you read a bit? We want you to read like kind of when we first hear about Crave, really, when the news that George has just signed his $1 million deal, or not signed it, been offered that deal. And kind of PJ's reaction will start it, and then we'll get George's side. So we will get both sides in this reading.
A passenger requested PJ's car. PJ knew she should accept the job, but she couldn't stop thinking about Dunn's book, a book that was hers, but not hers, a book that had made another writer rich while she struggled to pay rent on a 400-square-foot studio apartment. It would be read by everyone, establishing the reputation and career of a writer, but that writer would be Dunn rather than her. Yet another novel written by a man that received accolades, while those written by women were labeled chicklet, as if a fluffy infant bird had wandered across a keyboard, randomly pecking at letters. It was misogyny, pure and simple. PJ opened Crave, rage exploding through her thumbs, and drafted a nibble. Hey, George Dunn, congratulations on the sale of Up the Hill. Your book sounds a lot like my book, Halls of Power, which my agent sent you. Not good enough to publish, but good enough to steal? And now George receives that nibble. George's phone chimed, and a Crave notification appeared on the screen. It looked like someone was congratulating him on his success. He tapped his phone and read PJ Larkin's nibble, then read it again, hoping it didn't say what he thought it said. From the back of his chair, he grabbed a shapeless blue track jacket and pulled it on before reading the nibble again. George remembered PJ Larkin's novel, precisely because, like his book, it was about a politician who sexually assaults a subordinate. Though that's where the similarities ended. He'd admired Larkin's choice to tell the story, in part from the villain's point of view, and it had inspired him to add a few chapters to his book in the abuser's voice. That wasn't plagiarism.
That's R.L. Mazes, who's reading from her new book, A Complete Fiction. So we've heard there the perspective of PJ and then from George, and all of this is playing out on the social media platform Crave, but it's about these two books. And so just for some context, George is an editor at this small publishing house, and PJ had previously sent her novel in as a draft and had gotten feedback saying, this is great, but we're not going to publish it. Then George's book comes out and PJ has this reaction. So Me Too the Me Too movement is at the center of this as well, because both of their books are dealing with this. That's another thing that I don't want to say it's in the zeitgeist, because I don't want to minimize what has happened. But at the same time, it is something that has been, you know, discussed a lot. So why was that an element? Because you, I guess, could pick any topic, you know, to have similarities within a book. But why did you want to delve into that arena?
I mean, I guess because I feel like it is such an important subject, and that, especially given the subplot here with PJ's sister, whose story she's telling in her book, that the sister would be that even more upset if that were the subject. Meaning if it were just something that had happened to her sister and then PJ wrote about it, most things she might not be that upset about. But this thing in particular, she would be. And she would feel very exposed.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers going on. Like, at first you think, oh, it's, you know, PJ's right, right? I mean, that's what I liked about the back and forth chapters. Like, go PJ! And then it's like, oh, but poor George. When you read George's chapter, he doesn't deserve this. And but then you having the sister come in and say, like, you know, PJ brings all this attention to herself because this becomes kind of a scandal in publishing and on Crave. So that's when her sister doesn't find out about the book that PJ's been shopping around for a year or two until all this happens. And she's really unhappy. And how you deal with the family dynamics, both families actually have family dynamics, of the writers and what you write and how that affects your family. I thought that was a very interesting place to go. And I'm sure you know writers, and maybe even yourself, have had situations where maybe people close to you don't understand why you're writing what you're writing, or would rather that you didn't, you know? So talk a little bit about that and how that plays on a writer when they're really trying to craft a book.
I just don't think you can ever, as a writer, not be cognizant of how the stories you're telling are going to affect the people around you, especially the people close to you. And yet, it's the writer's material too. So the writer has experienced thing growing up in a certain family or whatever, and they might want to write about that. That's not unusual to want to write about that. But that story also belongs to that whole family. And the people in that family are going to feel different ways about that story being told, of course, in some ways, depending on how they're pictured. I have definitely, you know, I've written stories that had a kernel in my family. And every single time I've really worried about someone in the family reading them and what they would think. And I will say that, and someone once told me this, I'm going to go on a tangent. I once read my father a story that I wrote that really had him as an inspiration for a pretty tough guy, you know, not the easiest father. He loved that story. He didn't recognize himself at all. So it's all very interesting, and we definitely worry about it. There are ethical issues. There are moral issues to those issues. It's not just simply, oh, we're worried we'll be exposed for telling someone else's story. There's real questions we wrestle with. And that's probably why I wanted to bring it into the book, because I think the book is about writers and the experience of being a writer, and that's very much at the heart of that experience.
It really is a great insight into what it's like to be a writer, what it's like to be a publisher, just battling the dynamics of the entire industry. But also George gets quite self-reflective, because he remembers PJ's book, he really liked it, but he's saying to himself, well, okay, there were elements of it. I was inspired. This isn't plagiarism. You know, writers do this all the time. You read something and you're inspired by it, but is it copying? I mean, this idea of plagiarism versus inspiration versus just stuff that we absorb through osmosis, you know, in life. I think at one point PJ says, when I'm writing a book, I'm not reading any other books that even have similar details, because I don't want to even accidentally bring in somebody else's work. That must be a struggle as a writer.
It is a struggle, and I'm not PJ, but that those words that PJ says on that topic could literally have come right out of my mouth. And it is very true, when I'm writing about a subject, I try very hard not to read about it. My last book was about a burglar, And there are lots of novels about burglars. And I really didn't want to see anything about it until I was done, because there's that fear that you would even unintentionally copy, that you might forget a beautiful sentence that you read, and then it all of a sudden it appears in your book because you don't realize you read it.
We've seen a lot of this recently in music, where there have been very high profile lawsuits about that sounds so similar to this. And then you hear or you read observations about it, saying, look, there are only so many notes that exist. And so, of course, you're going to have some similarities. And, you know, I would imagine it's the same with writing. I mean, when you're dealing with anything that is to do with the human experience, of course, you're going to run into similar things with other people's books.
Right. I mean, I think that's right. And that's why some people say, you know, there are no new stories. And I think that's true. There are no new stories. There's only your individual way of telling them, of reflecting on them. So there will be similarities.
One of the aspects that you find out as the book goes on is, you know, PJ didn't just take her sister's story and change a few details and put that on the page. You find out later on that she did mountains of research. And I thought you could talk about how does the research inform a fiction writer in the same way? Because some writers maybe wouldn't have done all the research, say, PJ did. They had a good story. They change some of the details and they have the heart of the matter. And so I thought it was interesting when you get to the part of the story where you find that PJ really did try to do some research, a lot of research that isn't just her sister's story.
Right. And I think she also tried to change the story quite a bit. You know, she changed the family dynamics of her own family to the novel that she wrote that was about her sister, or at least inspired by her sister's story. But I think the reason, that is one of the reasons we do research, is it's almost whatever our own personal experience was that inspired the book, or our sister's personal experience was that inspired the book, truthfully, that's not rich enough. And that doesn't tell us enough. And we don't know enough knowing that. Or at least that's how I feel as a writer. And so that's how I made PJ feel. You know, I feel like you really do need to research these things so that you're not trapped in your own experience. I mean, the freedom that fiction gives us is to make things up. And it's very helpful to know more of the facts, not just your family's facts, but more of the facts on any particular topic, and to then move from there to creating a story that has both some of those reality-based facts and some things you just made up.
There's a great quote at the end, because I find PJ to be very unaware of herself and her own behavior until the end, where she really becomes a lot more self-aware. And towards the end, she says, being a fiction writer allowed her to hide the darkest parts of herself behind invented narratives. It was a privilege she'd stolen from George Donne. This is when she really is coming to grips with her own foibles and her own faults in all of this. So when you're writing the characters, I really loved, there's so many elements to PJ. She's riding, or she drives for a rideshare company. That's also an invented one. You don't use any of the ones that, the names of ones that we might be familiar with. But she's also really passionate about the environment, to the point that she's almost insufferable about it, and how she imposes that on everyone else, and her judgment about whether you're, you know, using a plastic bottle or you're driving a, you know, a car that's not electric. So do you map out the character? Does the character sort of evolve as you're writing the story? Because I found her and the other characters in the book very well rounded. So did they just evolve as you were writing the story, or did you say, no, I'm doing some character building and then I'm going to throw them all into this and see what happens?
I am a total pantser. You know, I just write by the seat of my pants. I revise later, but especially when I'm in the creating mode rather than the revising mode, I never map anything. I don't create an outline before I write that first draft. I just write to find out. I tell myself a story. And so, you know, having said that, then at some point, I looked at PJ, for example, and I said, wow, she could be too unpleasant at this point. How can I make her more pleasant? And then I strengthen her relationship with her closest friend, and I show her helping her closest friend. And I give her that aspect so that we don't completely hate her and we want to root for her, because the truth is I want readers to root for her and to want to read about her, of course, especially.
Well, I think you did a good job. You took the edges off her just in time, because I was getting annoyed with her. But then you rounded it out and you really get a sense that, yeah, she's kind of battling the demons. Many of us are.
Yeah, I think that's the point where alternating the narratives helps a lot, too, because, you know, maybe if we had 3 PJ chapters in a row, we would have, you know, gotten too annoyed with her. But the fact that they're 11 by times with George allows us to sit with PJ a little longer. And I wanted to ask you, though, about in the very beginning of the book, she picks up this guy, Franklin, and his wife has just died. She was killed and in a car accident. She was on a bike, and he was nowhere near the scene of the crime or, you know, the accident, but he blames himself. And PJ says, well, you didn't do it. He's like, well, how do you know I'm not to blame? He's just like, and she gives him all the reasons, like, you didn't, you know, whatever it was, you didn't you know, decide to get the groceries, or you didn't do that, whatever, all the things that have to happen to put the car and the wife in that place that he had nothing whatsoever to do with. And I thought about that as almost like, in fiction, you want to put these two people together, but you, as a writer, you have to put all these believable things. It's almost like reverse engineering what PJ says in that very opening part. Like, as a writer, you have to come up with all the things that will put these people together in a believable way, that they are the cause of each of whatever the action of the book is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's true. And sometimes I'll write a few chapters and I'll think, no, the reader's not going to go along for this ride. You know, this is not, I'm not putting them together believably enough. And then I go for a walk and I say, okay, what needs to change here so that it feels more natural, so that it feels more like this could really happen? I want to say, too, that that was another thing that I did very early on. I knew a lot of bad stuff was coming about PJ. I knew she was going to do some rough stuff. And so I wanted her to help this guy, Franklin, even if it was only in the sense of being kind to him and giving him an insight that might help him, to want to help him, at least to try to help him. So that right at the beginning we saw, okay, well, there's going to be more to her than just some of the actions she takes that the reader might not like.
Well, as we were saying, a lot of this is about the reality of being a writer, because PJ and George are both writers. And we hear about how hard it is to get published. And even if you write a fantastic book, there are very many dynamics, not necessarily to the extent that PJ experienced. But one of the reasons she was given for not having her book taken by the publisher was that we got a lot of Me Too books right now. So sometimes it's the timing. I mean, you're a writer. What's been your experience with just breaking in, even if you have the best book? How to get that in front of the right person at the right time when there's an appetite for this? I mean, it's not as simple as just being a great writer.
Oh my gosh, no. You have to be relentless. You have to be relentless. You know, I was talking a little earlier to Arson about the fact that this book, before it had Crave, so it was pretty much the same book, but it had Twitter instead of Crave. It was sent out to at least 24 by my agent, to at least 24 publishers who all said no. And I wasn't sure at that point that it would ever see the light of day. But I took it back and I thought, well, let me give it another look. And in this first couple of pages, I had the idea to create this new social media site that might add even more humor to the book than it had had before. And it took about 6 months to rewrite it with Crave, and then it sold in 2 weeks.
That made the difference.
That made the difference.
And what feedback had you gotten from the publishers? Did they say anything, or is it just no?
Oh my gosh, you know what we often hear? I didn't fall in love with it. That's what we hear. Because often what that means is, I got through it, I read it, I liked it, but there wasn't that intangible thing that put me over the top, or that made me say, I can sell 100,000 copies of these. Now, they don't usually sell 100,000 copies, but they want to at least believe that they can, you know? So, and I think adding Crave gave the book that intangible thing that made a publisher very excited about it.
You know, it's interesting because everybody's intangible thing is often something different. You know, working at the bookstore, I'm in a community of readers, and one person's favorite book, I read it, I'm like, it's okay. I got through it. I don't love it, but they love it, you know? And so it's such a weird, you know, subjective way to business to be in, you know? And if you're producing something, yeah, it can be really well written. It could even be, you know, experimental in a way that no one's ever done before. But if you can't get the love for whatever reason, and it could be that their dog peed on their rug that day. You know, I mean, really, you think of yourself as a reader. You know, sometimes I go back to things and I'm like, oh, this is a lot better than I thought, or I don't like it as much, you know, and that it didn't change any. I changed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I once sent an essay to an editor, and the essay was about my old dog. And she said to me, gosh, I really love this essay, and I just published an essay about an old dog.
So was that, I can't therefore publish a second essay about a dog?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. And timing, that's what you're talking about. You know, timing can be everything.
Well, it seems now as well, I mean, because social media is such a central part of your book, to this fictitious Crave site that we're hoping maybe an app developer is listening and might, you know, call RL and she'll give you the details. But because social media is such a big part of the book, social media is a huge place where books are getting promoted. I mean, as a writer now, are you getting that feedback from publishers going, you need to get on social media, you got to get in front of these reviewers? What do they call it? Book talk?
Yeah.
And there's all of these reading or reader influencers online and on all of the social media platforms. I mean, is that something now you have to do as a writer?
It is, and it's hard. I'm an older writer. I'm 62 years old. And so a lot of this stuff is not stuff that I would naturally do. You know, I wouldn't naturally be on TikTok. I wouldn't naturally necessarily be even on Instagram. I don't love being on any of them, to be honest. I find they take up too much of my mental space, and I'd rather it be took up with something else. But yes, publishers expect it of us, and we expect it of ourselves. I want my book to get out there. I want readers to find out about it. The right readers, just as you were saying, Arson, you know, won't be right for everybody. No book is right for anybody, for everybody. But I want the people who this book is supposed to reach to find out about it.
Well, in terms of who it's supposed to reach, I mean, it seems like writers themselves would eat this up, to get back to Crave, because you really do have such an insight as to what it's like to be a writer in the industry. I can't imagine as a writer how this would just, you know, could only resonate with you.
Well, I hope that's true. And it has been the feedback that I've been getting from some writers who have read it already. So that makes me happy and hopeful.
So what's next? What's your next subject matter? We've had a burglar who's also sort of telepathic with pets. That was your previous book.
Love that one too, by the way.
This one is about, you know, two, I don't want to even call them dueling, but two writers who have this antagonistic relationship through the book. Where do you go from here?
So I have a draft of a book, and I'm going to be honest, it's a very sad book. And it's sad because it's about something going on in the world right now that's sad, which is anti-Semitism. And the book takes that on as a subject, and it takes vigilantism and the idea of vigilantism and when is that right and when isn't it and is it ever right. But it's not funny at all. And so it's a little harder to work on it, right? It's fun to write something funny if you can. And it's to sit at your desk and laugh, right? So it's a hard book, and I hope that when I'm finished promoting this book, I will return to it and finish it, because I think it's an important subject. And maybe I'll figure out a way to lighten it up without in any way decreasing the importance of the issue, which is, of course, a very important issue.
Well, we look forward to reading that when it comes out. But in the meantime, A Complete Fiction is the latest book by our guest, R.L. Mazes. And I know you're on a book tour, and I know you're in conversation with writers. And so best of luck with all of that.
Thank you so much.
Well, as we always do at the end of each book club episode, we announce what we're reading. So, Arson, as we're hurtling towards 2026. What's the first book of the new year that we're inviting folks to read along with us in January?
Reading another local novelist, Edward Hamlin, Sonata in Wax is his newest book, and it's kind of a time-hopping musical mystery between a time period in World War I in Boston and a contemporary music producer.
Wow. Well, we look forward to that. That will be Edward Hamlin's second visit to the Radio Book Club and the first book of the new year. From KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran, and as always, my co-host of the Radio Book Club, Arsene Kashkashian. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.
Thank you both so much.